This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com. For a limited time, first-time customers can get a free trial by going to harrys.com/PEL.
You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, episode 132, part 2, continuing with guest Massimo Piliucci on the Stoicism of Seneca. Last time we had a lot of discussion of what Stoicism is as a practical philosophy, and really just started to dive deeply into the text, which is what we're going to be doing for the entirety of this second half. So we had just gotten up to section 3 here on the happy life, which is starts off, what is the happy life? It is peace of mind and lasting tranquility, which should be obvious from many things we've said here, but this seems a good time to jump to the letter 116 on self-control, the Stoic view of emotions, because that's where it addresses pretty directly some of the issues that we've been talking about here and the loss of a loved one in particular. Wes, do you want to start us on that?
It begins with this idea of whether we should have moderate emotions or no emotions. And the answer is going to be that any emotion is sort of this slippery slope. So the way he puts it, it's a middling level of sickness can't be useful. That's at the very beginning of the letter.
I myself don't see how it can be healthy or useful to have even a moderate amount of an illness.
It's interesting because wouldn't we also characterize our own living as being partly dead?
Yes.
So I found it difficult to read this passage without keeping in, as you were saying, Massimo, that, what they mean by emotions is just the bad ones. It sounds like he's talking about all emotions here. are you thinking that Seneca is using that term as you thought he was?
I think so, because otherwise it wouldn't make any sense, because in other letters he talks about friendship, he talks about positive stuff, and he's clearly isn't saying that those are things that one shouldn't have or do. Anytime you see something like this, like this passage, imagine you're talking about, let's say, take the typical emotion that Stoics have a problem with, in particular Seneca, anger. So he's saying that anger, for instance, or emotions like anger, they do come in degree, and Aristotle will say, some degree of anger, sort of righteous anger, for instance, is actually a good thing. Proper anger is a good thing. And Seneca, on the other hand, says, no, it's inherently destructive. It's madness. It's a temporary madness. And so it's not good in any measure whatsoever, which doesn't mean that you shouldn't be doing something, reacting to certain things. If you see an injustice, for instance, you should have your sense of justice, your virtue of justice should be exercised, and you should do something about it. But you shouldn't be angry about it.
Yeah, and in fact, in this passage, he alludes to this distinction between good and bad emotions. So he says, don't be afraid, I'm not snatching you from any of the emotions that you don't wish denied to you. And then later on, he says, for when I bid you to desire things, I shall permit you to wish for them. So that's a classic Stoic distinction between an emotion per se, and then the replacement that the Stoic sage will have, which is volition, which is here translated as wishing. So there's a healthy version of desire, in other words.
Correct. In fact, even before the end of section 1 of letter 116, he says, after I have banned desire, I will allow for wanting, so that you will do the same things without anxiety and with firmer resolve. That, I think, actually really does get at the distinction there. So you do want things, but you don't desire them in the destructive sense. It's not like, if I don't get that thing, I'm going to be miserable. No, it's okay to desire things, but with equanimity, without anxiety, as he said, with firm resolve.
But the rest of his sentence makes me think a lot of Pascal, like he's trying to win us over with the bargain, because the end of that sentence is, so that you will have the same things without anxiety and with firmer resolve, and will experience even your pleasures with greater intensity.
Right.
He's saying, well, even the things that you really want, you don't want to give up your pleasures. I'm trying to convince you to be a Stoic. And the reason you don't want to be a Stoic is you feel like, oh, Stoics have no fun. There's no good times if you're a Stoic. I don't want to give up my good times. And he's saying, if you follow the Stoic way, you will, in fact, have your pleasures even with more intensity.
And you'll get to them more rationally. You won't be distracted by other things that would keep you from your purpose.
Correct.
Where is he saying pleasures more intensely?
In my translation, which is the same one as Massimo's, it's in the second to last sentence of the first paragraph.
You will experience even your pleasures with greater intensity.
Mm-hmm. The second to last sentence is, after I've banned desire, I will allow for wanting. So you will do the same things without anxiety, with firm resolve, and will experience even your pleasures with greater intensity. So that's all positive stuff.
So our translation, Wes, this is the end of paragraph 1. I shall permit you to wish for them so you can act in the same way without fearing and with a more reliable intention, so that you can even be more aware of those pleasures. Surely they will reach you more effectively if you command over them than if you are their slave.
Yeah, that's not about heightening pleasure, though.
No. Well, it's not. Well, that depends on, you know, again, on the different translations, which is, I think, actually good that we're comparing a couple of ones, because so much hinges on exactly what he said and what he meant. But I think the general sense is pretty clear. If you arrive at things with reason and equanimity, you actually will get a deeper enjoyment from it than if you arrive from craving, from sort of being the slave of passions, as you would say, as opposed to their master.
So this whole section, it starts out with his interlocutor saying, it's natural for me to suffer from loss of my friend. And then he's giving warnings and then saying he could do this moderately. And then Seneca's argument is that, well, every emotion starts out weak at first, or, you know, so even if you have a moderate emotion, it'll gain strength. There'll be a certain kind of snowball effect. So he argues against that. And then the same thing with falling in love. So I took 116 as sort of a pretty direct argument against investing in the kinds of things that we usually think of as pleasures. And when he talks about volition, a volition has to be for a good thing, which can only be with respect to our virtue. So even though there can be these healthy emotions, these eupathai or whatever they're called, that they have to be directed towards being virtuous. And there is a little complex layer here in that virtue can involve the deselection or selection of the unpreferred or the preferred, because there can be virtue in that act. Actually, Seneca says this in one of the letters, I think. The good is not in the thing that you've preferred. The good is in the act, in acting naturally towards it. Yeah.
Correct. So. But let me read you, in my version, part of section 5, the bit about love.
Okay.
It says, as regards the wise man, he said, we shall see. But as for you and me, who are a long way from achieving wisdom, we had better refrain so as to avoid a condition that is frantic, out of control, enslaved to another, and lacking in self-worth. Now, when I read that, to me, he wasn't describing love as a good emotion. He was describing lust, which is a whole different thing. He was describing this being mad and doing crazy things, which, of course, as a Stoic, he cannot condone. I don't recognize that as the mature love that I was talking about earlier. When you love a person in a mature way that has been developing over months and years and so on and so forth, that's not what you do. You're not frantic. You're not out of control. You're not enslaved to the other. In fact, even modern psychologists would say that being enslaved to the other, it's not a good thing. It's not a healthy thing, right?
So you look in their eyes and you say, I prefer you.
That would be a less anxiety-producing way to say things in the...
I think it's actually a product, right? The Stoic cards, the Stoic Valentine's Day cards.
You have to say, yeah, I love you, but if you died, I'd be okay. Put that in your Valentine, just so you know.
But he does just use this, in my translation, this phrase, keeping aloof. So let us keep aloof, staying aware of our weakness. You know, I think it's still open, Massimo. Your suggestion is a very interesting one, that there is a Stoic version of love, which I think would still be different than what we typically think of as love. But maybe it is just what we would call mature love. Because what he rebels against is this idea that, well, it's all well and good when that person is kind to you, but when they, if the beloved despises you, then you're inflamed by pride. And it seems to me, if there is a Stoic version of love, it's hard to reconcile what we think of as romantic love with that.
I think that's a fair point.
It's like filial piety, but with your spouse. That's the Stoic kind of love.
That's right.
Just respect.
You wouldn't be swept off your feet or run into a jealous rage if you're a Stoic in love.
Correct. And I don't know you guys, but I'm pretty sure I'm the older in the group. And I
better be careful.
Yeah, I certainly have had... I'm now in a much better relationship because it is, in fact, that kind of calm love rather than being swept and being a slave. But, you know, that may be my personal preference.
It is interesting that all the immature kinds of love get lumped together, that I think that a purely lust-based one and something that is swept away in this sort of romantic ideal are actually quite different. I mean, you could make an argument that one is just a sublimated version of the other in the classic romance of knightly courtship or something, that carnal desire doesn't explicitly come into it, but you know what's going on. You know why this person is freaking out quite that much. But certainly in the experience of it, you know, I just find it interesting culturally that in this kind of setting, they're always, of course, just lumped together, even though presumably this guy didn't read Freud.
That's right. That's right. Modern psychology does make this distinction fairly clear. In fact, you can actually study the hormonal profiles that characterize the lust, the romantic phase, and the more quiet, mature phase, and they're very different. They're sort of biologically, we react differently in those cases. And it is the case that we value the long-lasting love, the third kind. And we think that the romantic stuff actually goes well only if it does, in fact, eventually translate or mature into the long-lasting, more quiet emotion. If it just stays romantic and, you know, people commit suicide or something, or they do crazy things because of that, we don't really value that much as a society, right?
Or the romantic part goes away and they find out they have nothing in common, which is a very typical...
Yeah, reason comes back and then you say, oh, crap.
But the Stoics would have nothing good to say about Romeo and Juliet, right?
No.
But they would probably like computer programs to supplement our matchmaking and stuff like that. Objective. Find a partner that objectively matches your right. needs, not that you actually like.
Unless you're using the computer program to objectively match your romantic needs as opposed to your mature love needs.
I mean, that's getting pretty far from Seneca.
Maybe this is a segue back into 92, where there's this broader idea that, well, I like this idea that pleasure is the good of cattle. So the key to happiness is not pleasure, but virtue and reason and things like that. So I think we are about to get into section 3.
Peace of mind and tranquility. How does a man reach the condition of peace and tranquility? By gaining a complete view of truth, by maintaining in all that he does, order, measure, fitness, and a will that is inoffensive and kindly, that is intent upon reason and never departs therefrom, that commands at the same time love and admiration.
So that's sort of hinting at this idea that knowing what is truly good and what is not truly good is the key. So knowing that these external circumstances are not truly good or bad, but only virtues.
I just found in the combination of this and one of the earlier letters where he admonishes people that use words that are too big, that make things more complicated than they are, and really, you know, says straight up pretty much that what you need for virtue is simple. That really the challenge, which is why, again, we have epistle after epistle after epistle, is keeping it in mind, is meditating upon it, is doing what you actually know to be true. So it seems like it's not a very difficult task here to keep a complete view of truth, like that truth itself is something that is not esoteric and you need to go up on a mountain or become as wise as Plato to gain it. But it is something that the Stoics already know this. It was figured out by Zeno, or at least Chrysippus. And it's a matter of getting a complete view of it, keeping it in mind and maintaining it through all your actions, which seems very fatuous to
me.
Well,
he uses this, in my translation, this phrase, clinging to judgment. So that's the hard part, because the formula is rather clear, right? It's this very hard and fast distinction between your own character and your own comportment of the world, which is the domain of the good and of virtue and of vice, and then everything else. So to know what is true, to have a complete view of truth, is to just know all that external stuff is not actually good or bad. But to actually know it, it's one thing to believe that, but actually to know it involves this resolute clinging, and to live that way is the hard part.
You guys mind if we go, actually, now that you mentioned, to 49, which is on the shortness of life, or in the more recent translation, it's called remembering old times, but it's letter number 49. That bit, I think, that you mentioned about the logicians, you know, wasting time, I think it's interesting. So it's right at the end of section 5 into 6 and then 7. These logicians think they are accomplishing something. I am not saying one should not give such things a look, but it should be only a look, a greeting from the doorway, just enough to make sure we're not taken in by them, thinking that there is something deep and arcane value in what they do. And then skip a little bit and go to the beginning of 7. I have no time to spare for chasing down ambiguous terms and exercising my ingenuity on them. And then in the second half of 8, while enemy spears come flying within the gate and the ground beneath our feet quakes with tunneling and sapping, I should sit there idly posing little conundrums like this. What you have not lost, you have, but you have not lost horns, therefore you have horns. That or some other intellectual lunacy along the same lines. I find this interesting because this is a sharp reminder of the fact that the Stoics were interested in practical philosophy. But they were not anti-intellectual. I mean, as we know, they made major contributions to logic. They basically invented predicate logic, and they came up with an entirely different type of syllogistics compared to Aristotle's. They wrote about what we today call natural science or natural philosophy. In fact, Seneca himself wrote essays on comets and things like that. So it's not like they were anti-intellectual. They studied epistemology, they studied philosophy of language, they studied natural history and metaphysics. But it was all toward the goal of figuring out how to live your best life. And I think these bits that I just read from Seneca are clearly reminding of that. There's something very similar in Epictetus, actually, where he says you can spend a lot of time after playing the games of the logicians, but in the end, what matters is how you're living your life the way you should be living it.
Yeah, 12, for as the tragic poet says, the speech of truth is simple, so it should not be complicated, for nothing is less appropriate than that tricky cleverness for minds that are attempting great tasks. It's easy to take these kinds of comments about philosophy, and we saw them in Epictetus too, that he emphasized the practical, to take them personally. I kind of think that if we had in mind clearly who he was reacting to, we would probably think that those people were spinning bullshit too, and not that he's not actually talking about philosophy, the kind that we would like. So it could just be a personal grudge here.
It was mostly reacted to sophists. The sophists loomed very large still in Rome. And of course, you have to remember a major inspiration for the Stoic philosophy in general is the Euthydemus by Plato. And that's the dialogue where Socrates actually has a conversation with the two sophists. And it is there that Socrates makes the argument that virtue is its own good. It's the supreme good. It's the chief good because it's the only thing that it's good by itself. Mm-hmm. Everything else has limited value, but virtue is the thing that actually it's always good, right? And the Stoics were very, very much Socratic from that perspective. And therefore, they were also anti-sophists.
An element here in this essay that seems new as compared to Epictetus is this idea that life is war. That's why we should not waste ourselves listening to the dialecticians, is because life is a war.
Yeah, very end of 96. Life is a battle.
Life, Lucilius, is a campaign. That is why those who endure the trials march uphill and down to rough country and put themselves into the most dangerous sorties are the heroes and leaders of the camp. The ones who are quietly running away at ease while others do the hard work are total doves. They are only safe because they are despised. It's pretty flowery language, true. In Latin, it sounds even better, actually.
Oh, yeah. No, I love this from a poetic, from a rhetorical standpoint. I thought this was a great reading. He definitely could have been giving these as sermons or orations. So he's trying to say, you shouldn't complain about things. This whole on facing hardships. Really, the evil is not that you're suffering the hardship, but it is that you chafe and complain. That is the problem. And this should sound very familiar by now. And says, again, things that are similar to Epictetus in there, that all these hardships, they're not there just by accident. They're by design. They're part of the tax on life. Just so you should pay your taxes without complaining, you should pay the taxes on life, which is all your loved ones will die. Things are not going to work out. There's going to be a lot of dispreferred things that are going to turn up. If you want long life and immunity from ills, well, that's a womanish cry. Come on. And he gets this very, that's when he just goes into this martial, the thing that Massimo just quoted at the end, that people who live in, would you rather live in a life in a cafe or in a camp? So what is it?
So it is really about, you know, it's sort of analogous to the Nozick thought experiment mm-hmm. that Massimo mentioned. It really is about what's implicit in your attachment to life. What does life mean? Does life just mean one long sort of hedonistic trip? Or is my attachment to life actually, does it actually include an attachment to struggle, which is, I think we think, necessary to meaningfulness and necessary to evaluating our lives as a good thing. So those two things start to pry apart at that point. So it's not just we got to pay our dues if we want to have pleasure. It's that there's actually something preferable about the struggle.
Well, and this, but the struggle that doesn't feel like a struggle. I'm having a hard time putting together this life is a battle with this Stoic orientation overall. What is the battle with? It could either be a battle with life's misfortunes. So it could be like the first noble truth in Buddhism, life is suffering. Life is a battle in that sense. Or it could be like, was it the second or third noble truth? In other words, the battle is with yourself, which seems to be more in line with overall what all the Stoics are saying throughout, which in that case, it just, again, seems like a kind of a weird self-reinforcing circle that you should eschew pleasure and the easy life because life is a battle to resist pleasures in the easy life.
I think not in that sense, just in the sense that there are misfortunes. There are bad things that happen and things go wrong and you have to...
You shouldn't resist them because they're painful.
Well, the thing is, winning the battle means some degree of aloofness from that, right? So not seeing them as inherently good or bad, and so not being as distressed by them. And here I think we get to this distinction between the Stoic sage and everyone else. The Stoic sage is almost an ideal, right? Who's really going to reach the point where they have complete equanimity? I mean, I know the Stoics thought it was possible, but it's also very, very difficult. So for the average person, even if you're improving, even if you have embodied a significant amount of Stoic practice into your life, there's still the usual sort of struggle. It's not, I haven't made and now I have complete equanimity in the face of misfortune.
I think it helps if you go, somebody mentioned it very briefly. The passage before, it's still on 96, but the passage before the one about the bottle and stuff, at section 3, I think it's very indicative of what Seneca may have meant there. He says, you were troubled by pain in your bladder. You received worrying letters. Your losses continued. Let me get to the point. You feared for your life. Well, didn't you know that in praying for old age, you were praying for these things? A long life contains them all, just as a long journey contains dust, mud, and rain. Again, I find this is a very sort of pragmatic and realistic attitude toward life, right? It's like, okay, you want to live a long life? Great. It's like going on a long journey. Not everything is going to be pleasurable. Not everything is going to go your way. In fact, lots of things can go wrong. The longer the journey, the more things are likely to go wrong. And just, if this is what you want and you have certain benefits from living a long life, you have exercised your virtues for a long time, but you also have these things that just come with it. That's just the way the world is. This is just the way human nature is. And so you should accept them and not complain about it.
You want to live to be 100, you better start saving for your medical bills.
Yep, that's right.
Part of what's a little bit weird is that the rest of that paragraph, it's a kind of, you wanted a long life, don't be such a pussy, and don't be bitching so much and toughen up, man. Be a man. And the part of that is, besides the tone, is the notion that he seems to be appealing to the virtue of manliness and the virtue of steadfastness, not from the sense of being oriented properly towards the good as a good Stoic, but from being a badass. The virtue of being a badass, that's what he seems to be appealing to.
This kind of value that he should have overcome himself already. That is the kind of thing the Stoic thinks is beneath him.
Okay. I kind of like the idea of a Stoic as a badass.
But I think this is the womanish cry part of the argument, which I think is not exactly an essential part of it, because he starts out with this idea. Here's what life is. It includes also dust and mud. And then the interlocutor has an obvious response. Well, I want a life that's long, but also immune from all ills. And then there's the womanish cry remark. But then there's this remark, may gods and goddesses alike forbid that fortune keep you in luxury. So what's the idea here? And then the final sort of coup de grace, the cafe, life in a cafe versus life in a camp. There's that badass element. But I think, again, the idea is that there really is something preferable about what we would think of as the bad things that happen. Think about the implications of struggle. Perhaps those are the things against which we exercise virtue. Maybe virtue becomes less relevant if there's no struggle or something like that. So there's something about inherent value in the struggle itself.
But don't we have something like that also, of course, not of Stoic origin, but in sort of modern society, right? Look at every movie you go to see, and what is the movie about? It's about its struggle. And then it ends with, and they live happily ever after. And you never see actually that living happily ever after. Why? Because it's boring.
It's boring.
There's nothing going on there, right? So what you like to that, even today, we go to see a movie or we read a book, either drawn from real life examples or not, or entirely fictional. What we value is the struggle, is the overcoming of obstacles. That's what we think makes really a person, the test, the character of the person. That's, I think, where Seneca, and in general, the Romans, we also need to be wary of not making the sort of the presentist mistake or sort of projecting too much of our own values and situations into the different culture to these 2,000 years ago. That part, however, remains valid today. We do think that people's worth is tested in battle, so to speak, not literally in battle necessarily, but in adversity. Because otherwise, and that's why, for instance, he says in my translation in that part that we're reading now, may neither gods nor goddesses keep you in the lap of luxury. Why not? Why would I want not to be in the laps of luxury? Well, because my character isn't going to be tested there. I have to think that my life is going to be easy. And so I will never know if I actually am a good person or not, because everything comes easy to me.
So we maybe leave to the side the question of whether any of the preferred things are of ultimate importance, because it seems we've already said on the Stoic picture, no, it's just virtue is of ultimate importance. But life is a battle is not just... It wasn't an accident that I gave the two options as being recognition of the first Buddhist noble truth, life is suffering, and recognition of the third truth that suffering can be addressed, that these things, of course, are supposed to hook together. So life being a battle, well, it is a battle for the stuff that we're trying to accomplish, whatever it may be. It's got to be something that is honorable, but certainly Seneca had no problem with you as a Stoic. You didn't have to be a monk. You could take up a public life. You could try to make the world a better place. This was an issue that was raised in our last, in our Epictetus discussion. It seemed there was no room for Stoic revolutionaries. It seems like, though, Seneca does say things like, come on, don't dress funny. You don't buck the trends, partially for the same reasons Epictetus had, that we don't want to make Stoics look like freaks and we want to spread the Stoic word.
Yes.
But also because it seems that there are legitimate political purposes that you could have and you could work very hard toward them, not because the thing that you're working toward is ultimately of value, but because you're working toward it exemplifies your great character, which that itself is a value. So the same thing, you know, the way value gets treated throughout, which reading was it, Wes, that you were referring to? I know we pulled it out of the secondary source that we read, but I forget which one that we read that says, yeah, these things we're working toward are not valuable in themselves, but it's the fact that we are doing it that has the value.
It's section 11 of 92. This is good because I think there's a lot more to discuss in 92. So it's good that we get back to that. What then comes, the retort, if good health, rest, and freedom from pain are not likely to hinder virtue, shall you not seek all these? Of course I shall seek them, but not because they are goods. I shall seek them because they are according to nature and because they will be acquired through the exercise of good judgment on my part. So good judgment there being critical because it's about the virtue involved in good judgment. What then will be good in them? This alone, that it is a good thing to choose them. For when I don suitable attire, or walk as I should, or dine as I ought to dine, it is not my dinner, or my walk, or my dress that are goods, but the deliberate choice which I show in regard to them, as I observe in each thing I do a mean that conforms to reason.
Yeah, that actually is perfectly in line with the standard Stoic teaching. That is, the things are not good in and of themselves. It's your judgment about things, that it's good or not, that makes them good or not.
Which I don't know that it helps. So verse 12 here, let me also add that the choice of neat clothing is a fitting object of a man's efforts. For man is by nature a neat and well-groomed animal. Okay.
Yes, this actually, you know, this points to a real problem, which is that we have these two levels of evaluation. One is the good and the bad, which applies to virtue and to ourselves. But then the preferable and the not preferable. Where does that plane of valuation come from, and how is it really justified? To say it's natural because it happens very often. Mark, I think you were kind of alluding to this earlier, but this for me is one of the real problems. Once you're not judging things in terms of happiness or some other end, it's easy to see the idea of, okay, I am making a deliberate choice according to reason, and that relates it back to virtue. But why is neatness according to reason as opposed to sloppiness? That's really unclear.
In my translation, that phrase that began section 12, what was it in yours, Mark? It said,
let me also add that the choice of neat clothing.
Yeah. So when I read, mine says, let me elaborate. Selecting clean clothing is something a person ought to do because a human is by nature a clean and seemly animal. Accordingly, while clean clothing is not in itself a good, the act of selecting it is because goodness is present not in the thing, but in the quality of the selection.
Yeah.
It is the doing that is honorable, not the actual thing we do. You were saying, Wes, that there seemed to be a question of why it is that this particular thing is there's a virtuous act in it. And when I had read it originally, I had picked out the part about it just being in the selection itself, that activity of selection. And I thought that the problem there would be the question of how you do that selecting well. Like, so you want to say you select it according to quality and according to nature. And that seemed to be where the challenge would be. You've sort of put it in the activity of selecting, not that you have good clothes. So you push off to the side that you have fancy clothes. It's just the fact that you selected well is what becomes the virtue.
Yeah. So I think the strong part of this is once you've established that being clean or being neat is reasonable, then I think you have a really strong argument for saying the reasonable selection itself is virtuous. So that's why I do these things. But saying why that particular thing is reasonable is the hard part, because I can no longer use health or, well, can I use health? Maybe I can use health. But I can no longer, yeah, I could use health, but I can no longer use my happiness as the ultimate standard for why I'm clean, right? So I no longer get the typical tricks of justification here. So what makes this reasonable as opposed to not reasonable? That, I think, is the hard part.
That's an excellent point. But I think there are a couple of ways to go about it. One is that one of the four Stoic virtues was practical wisdom. And practical wisdom is the idea that if you're practically wise, you always know how to behave no matter what the circumstances are. right? So selecting the right clothing for the right occasion, so to speak, can be an exercise in practical wisdom. Because depending on where you are, depending on what the situation is and so on and so forth, there are certain things that are going to be appropriate and other things that are not going to be appropriate.
And this is a categorical, not a hypothetical imperative here. It's just strain appropriate. It's not appropriate given your desires. Is that right?
No, I would say that everything that Stoics do is, it's always conditional. That is, if you want to act virtuously, right? If you want to do certain things, then certain choices become rational and others become not rational. In that, I'm actually using Lawrence Baker's A New Stoicism, where he tries to update and sort of interpret pretty much all of the Stoic ethics in terms of sort of conditional imperatives, not in terms of absolute imperatives, right? But now, the other way of going about it maybe is going back to Aristotle. So Aristotle famously said at some point, I think it's in the Nicomachean Ethics, that what goes in Athens doesn't go in Sparta and vice versa. Meaning that the Greeks and the Romans were very keenly aware of the fact that things like customs change with location, change with the situation. And so again, to do the right thing in terms of things like selecting your clothing or to do the virtuous thing depends on the situation in which you find yourself. And so there is a right selection, but that right selection doesn't go as deep as, you know, human nature itself. It just goes into, okay, well, you find yourself in this situation. So what is the good selection, the best way to go about this particular situation?
But what are the standards of that? So it certainly can't be pleasure, because implicit in pleasure is that this thing, you know, dressing neat or being clean is good. That's right out the window. No.
So it's a custom, just that cleanliness?
But why not act against custom? Why not say, okay, I'm going to show up to this party dressed really sloppily, which actually, you know, some people might see as being uber fashionable. But anyway, I'm going to dress really sloppily, and that's what seems reasonable to me. How do I make the argument to someone? Well, actually, no, it's, you know, dressing neatly or cleanly is what's reasonable in this case. By what standard do I make that argument?
Because what is your goal in going to the party, right? I mean, remember, for the Stoics, the important part was, in terms of sort of following human nature, was this idea that human nature is the nature of a social animal. So you don't want to go, presumably, it's not reasonable to go to a party with the intention of disrupting it or the intention of causing embarrassment to your host or something like that. That would be not the non-social thing to do, and therefore it's not reasonable to do it, right?
Unless it was to show them a more virtuous path, because you, like Socrates, want to show that wealth is not important, and so that care to grooming is trivial, and I'm deep, and I want you to be deep too, and so that's why I go to the party.
Yeah, but it's not, keep in mind though, that proselytizing about virtue is not automatically virtuous for the Stoic.
Yeah. Writing 120 letters about virtue is...
Right. But not only that, I think that your point is interesting, because it does bring up this idea that Stoicism was not a monolithic doctrine. Mm-hmm. So for instance, you see Cato the Younger, who apparently did on purpose, even though he was of senatorial rank, he actually did often go out in, you know, not in rags quite, but certainly underdressed for a senator. And he was going in the field and walking instead of being on the horse. And he was doing that to make a point. To make the point that dressing, you know, fancy in a fancy way is not important, that having the luxury of going in marching on a horse is not important. So Seneca probably had a different take on things than Cato, and Cato had a different take as Epictetus. So we should be wary of sort of trying to fit every, you know, all of Stoicism into one mold, because clearly that they disagreed among themselves, as it's reasonable to disagree within a philosophical framework.
All right, before we go further with that, let's stop and talk about our sponsors. Again, we're going to bring Seth back, who will be on the next episode to talk about the latest offering from The Great Courses.
Hey, folks, we're really excited to tell you about The Great Courses Plus video learning service. You got an unlimited access to a huge library of Great Courses lecture series in so many fascinating subjects like science, philosophy, religion, history, cooking, you name it. We really like The Great Courses Plus, and they are giving our listeners an incredible opportunity right now. You can watch one of their popular courses, The Fundamentals of Photography, absolutely free. The Fundamentals of Photography is filmed in partnership with the National Geographic and is taught by professional photographer Joel Sartori. I have been watching it and really enjoying it, as I am not a great photographer and I wanted to learn a lot more about this subject. It is a great way to learn how to take stunning photographs like a pro, helping to capture memories of what we see and experience. So just this morning, I was up to lecture 9, which is on composition. And there's this fascinating sequence where Joel Sartori takes you through how he puts together a picture of his son, who's using a bubble maker, by starting with different lenses and different perspectives and moving around physically, changing lenses till he finds the composition where he cleans up the space and really brings out the character of what he's looking for. It was really, really helpful to me to see it visually how he unrolled that. For a limited time, the Great Courses Plus is offering you guys a chance to stream this course, The Fundamentals of Photography, which is a $235 value, as well as hundreds of other courses for free. You can stream from any internet-connected TV, PC, or through the Great Courses apps. But this free offer is only available for a limited time, so hurry up. To stream The Fundamentals of Photography from the Great Courses Plus for free, you must go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus, spelled out, PLUS.com/PEL.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by Harry's. Harry's is a shaving supplies company. It was started by two guys who were kind of sick of the standard shaving experience that most of us are very familiar with, going to the pharmacy to buy overpriced razors. Harry's will deliver razors to your door for half the price, and these are really high-quality razors. The two guys who started this company, they bought a factory in Germany that's been producing really high-quality blades for almost 100 years. So they're basically charging you factory-direct prices for something that's really high-quality. Getting started with Harry's is really easy. Over a million guys have done that. The website is very streamlined. It takes 30 seconds to place an order. You can get a customized shaving kit. The kit they sent me is called the Winston set, and I can tell you it's really nice. There's a ergonomic, really well-weighted handle. It's also really well-designed. It doesn't look like the toy that you're used to getting at the pharmacy. The blades themselves, so it's a 5-blade cartridge with a lubricating strip, and it's on a hinge. With 5 blades, it gives a very, very close shave. And the shaving cream they sent me is also really nice, smells really nice. So if you'd like a better shaving experience for a limited time, Partially Examined Life listeners can get a free kit. That kit includes a 5-blade cartridge, the ergonomic handle, a foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover. To get that free kit, just go to harrys.com/PEL. That's harrys.com/PEL.
Okay, thanks, guys. So Massimo had just given his response to the whole why should I dress nicely at a party argument.
I think that you bringing up these differences and the fact that these are hypothetical imperatives is the key to making this relevant. I mean, it's fun for me to go through and pick out goofy things in the text, and that's kind of what we did with Epictetus. Right. But the way we started this discussion is, how could you interpret it charitably or update it for the current day? And if we say that what Stoicism is trying to tell you is to deal with the challenges that you face. And even though Seneca might sound very fatuous in saying, oh, well, just, you know, the truth, pretty much what you should do is just laid out in front of you. Just pay attention. And no, we think that there's more tussling that goes into figuring out actually what you should do in all the circumstances and really what goals, what very high level goals you should pursue. And therefore, how you should then align a lot of different preferences. It's not just as simple as thinking, how can I be virtuous today? But once you've figured out being as deep and reflective and sensitive to the ethical implications of what you might do in the environment that you're in, once you come up with a life plan, then on a daily basis, I could see how the sort of practice, Massimo, that were describing of, I don't want to get distracted by getting jealous of somebody. I don't want to get irritated by people in traffic. There's just so many things that could just, yes,
politics.
That could,
well, which is my,
you don't want to get sucked into other people's conflicts, right? That you want to really keep perspective. And it just seems whatever the details of what your life plan turns out to be, that the Stoic tools of approaching your psyche in this way, and that, yeah, I could exert quite a bit more control than I do over, you know, making sure that what I decide in the morning that I want to get done actually gets done, and that it gets done in a way that doesn't step on toes in a way that I don't intend to, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I wonder if you guys mind going to letter 62, which is really brief, but I think it makes interesting points. That's the one that it's entitled, depending on your translation, On Good Company or Living the Inner Life. So it starts out saying, you know, they're lying. Those people who wanted to look as if the pressures of their jobs prevent them from engaging in liberal studies.
Right. Right.
It is all pretense, for they themselves keep adding to their activities. If they're busy, it is their own fault. And then it continues a couple of lines later. I do not give myself over to activities. I only lend myself, and I don't go looking for reasons to waste my time. And then in section 2, second sentence is, and I don't linger with the people I am thrown in with merely by circumstance or by some reason arising from public service, Instead, I choose the very best company, and it is to them that I entrust my mind in whatever place, in whatever age they have lived. I find this very helpful in my own framework for making decisions. One of the things that people that know me will tell you is that I'm pretty efficient about doing things. You know, I get a lot of things done. And one of the ways I do that is because I follow precisely what Seneca is saying here. I don't give myself to activities just for the idea of being busy. I choose very carefully what I spend my time doing and why I do it. And the same goes, and this has been more clear to me more recently, the same goes for the company that I keep. You know, I've always had this idea that, you know, good friends, you know, this is an Aristotelian idea, really, that friendship is important. And so you want to spend your time with what Aristotle would call friends of virtue. But since I've started reading and practicing Stoicism, this idea has become even more prominent. I've actually, you know, literally been examining, you know, my acquaintances and my friends and saying, okay, so what do we spend time doing and talking about? And, you know, who are these people? And which one of these are really good for me to hang around and which one are not? It sort of really makes you think about the urgency of, you know, you only have a finite amount of time on earth. And why the hell are you wasting it with people that are not worth it or doing things that are not worth it?
Mm-hmm. Well, in light of that, we're flattered that you preferred to do this podcast as opposed to didn't prefer to do it.
Yes, that was a backhanded compliment, my friend.
You know, I read this wrongly initially, that when he gets to number three, he says, oh, Demetrius, for instance, the best of men I take about with me, and talks about, I thought he was talking about, because he says, I spend my time in the best company no matter in what lands they may have lived or in what age, I let my thoughts fly to them. So what I thought he was talking about is not Demetrius being an actual real acquaintance of him's, but this being an author.
It's Demetrius, right?
That he would carry around the text. That, in other words, a lot of these people that want to deal with me on a daily basis are kind of a waste of my time. I'd rather spend time with Seneca. I'd rather read a book from 1,000 years ago. So it kind of resonated with me, even though taken to an extreme, that would be a little silly. But what else could he mean by this, my time in the best of all men, no matter where they may have lived and what age, I let my thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think being alone is actually a crucial part of this, because if you fear being alone to a great degree, you're driven into the arms of whoever's around.
I read it the same way. That is, if I do not have a friend that is worth spending my time right now, then I'd rather go to a book and read a classic and have a dialogue with this author. And actually, again, this is the way I've always thought about engaging with good literature and good philosophy. I do think of it as a conversation with really interesting people, and I'm much rather spend my time, you know, a significant portion of my time doing that than, you know, watching the Kardashians or something.
Or football, which is what I'm about to do.
Yeah, well, I do watch some soccer, so it's like...
Do people have notes on any of the other essays that, like, oh man, I need to read this quote because this is so awesome?
Okay, since you're asking, I do have one.
Sure.
It's on the first letter that we were supposed to read, the number four, on the terrors of death, mm-hmm. and coming to terms with death. Because that's a topic that it's actually particularly interesting to me. This is one of the topics that actually has brought me to Stoicism to begin with. I found this image interesting. It says, this is number two of letter four. Surely you remember what joy you felt when you set aside your boy's clothes and put on a man's toga for your first trip down to the forum. A greater joy awaits you once you set aside your childish mind, once philosophy registers you as a grown man. This resonated with me personally for a number of reasons. First of all, I grew up in Rome. I know what it is like to walk down the forum. Now, of course, it's not the same, you know, it's not the forum as it was 2,000 years ago, but I literally walked inside the forum. I wasn't wearing a toga. I was probably wearing a t-shirt and jeans. But nonetheless, I know what he's talking about. I know exactly the environment that he's talking about. I know what it looks like. And this was a major thing to do for Romans, right? So to shed the boy's clothes and put on the man's toga. This was an important rite of passage for Roman youth. And it marked the passage to maturity and so on and so forth. And then the second bit, the one that says, you know, imagine that what awaits you now is it's a similar experience where you let go of your childish mind and you approach philosophy. This is exactly the feeling that I had the first time that I did encounter philosophy. I studied philosophy for the first time in high school, because in Italy you have to study 3 years of philosophy in high school. And I was lucky enough that my teacher was very enthusiastic, very, very brilliant, you know, that she really made the topic come alive. And that was the feeling. It's like, wow, all of a sudden my mind was sort of expanding very rapidly beyond anything that I had conceived before. And that's because I was all of a sudden in dialogue with all these dead white people who, you know, had written all these interesting things so long ago. So this particular passage, you know, letter 4, section 2, really resonated with me personally.
That's interesting. I do have something in my notes here about four. It's not related to what you just said, but I think it's worth mentioning. So this idea near part six that no good thing helps its possessor unless his mind is ready to lose it. And here I would say, to be technically strict, he must mean no thing that seems good helps its possessor unless his mind is ready to lose it. And then in 12, we get this idea that in a way, being conscious of death helps free us from the necessities of life. In other words, we can be, by accepting death, it's not that we're just less afraid of death, but we are less driven by the necessities of life in general. So in this case, this idea of being preemptively ready to lose things, so it's not in a way just abandoning these things, that, you know, these preferables. In a way, our experience of them is enhanced, at least, you know, according to my reading of this passage. We can enjoy, in the lowercase sense of enjoy, things in life in a deeper way if we're ready to lose them.
We can have joy as opposed to pleasure. Yeah, that was a whole other essay. Yep.
Well, except that joy would have to be virtue-directed. But anyway, it's always entangled.
And there are some modern philosophers who made the same point, right? So there's this famous essay on the Macropolis case, I think it's called, which is a sort of based on a fictional story where this woman has basically this drinking at the fountain of youth. And so she keeps living for a long time. But in the end, she decides consciously not to drink anymore from the fountain. She wants to die because things become less and less meaningful, precisely because they sort of blurred one into the other. They all become the same thing because it's always the same sort of set of experiences over and over and over. There's nothing special happening. There's nothing that has meaning anymore. And so she decides death. So this is the idea that it is death. It is the impending death that makes things urgent and meaningful. Otherwise, it would just be a one long blur.
Well, this being unto death, I mean, it's interesting what a different... If you just compare the seize the day, right, you might be dead tomorrow. That's the romantic ideal. But yet what it would command you to do is exactly opposite to what the Stoic would command you to do, seemingly.
That's right.
And we get that in this, really, on both the On Old Age and on the Shortness of Life essays that we read. One weird thing in this On Old Age one that jumped out at me was he quotes Heraclitus. He's arguing why it's okay if you're going to die tomorrow. Or you should live like it's okay, like you're going to die tomorrow. And he quotes Heraclitus, one day is like every day. One day is equal to the others by resemblance. Or maybe this is not a quote of him, it's a discussion of him. Since even the longest lapse of time contains nothing that you would not find in one day. So he seems to say that what is really important, I mean, this of course lines up with everything else we've said here. If what's really important is virtue, then as long as you're not sleeping through the day, as long as you're awake and thinking about this, then everything that is really important is right there. You don't need it to be there tomorrow. You can fulfill the purpose, which I'm trying to think how this connects to the Nozick thought experiment. Like, you know, you can get in the machine and live weeks of pleasure. Or let's say this was a sci-fi thing. I can't remember exactly where this is from, but you're about to die. Maybe this is Doctor Who or something. You're about to die. So we'll put you in a machine that instead of you dying now, it'll kind of speed up your consciousness. So you will live like in Nozick's experience machine and get to have lots more adventures. And that's preferable, though, to you simply dying tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so that's a sort of variation on the thought experiment that, yeah, okay, of course we'd like to have a full life lived outside the machine than in the machine, but would we prefer a full life lived in the machine, or, you know, a life of hedonism lived in the machine, to you're going to die tomorrow? And Seneca is taking the hard line and say, no, you'd want the day out of the machine, even if it's your last day, because the reality, the meaningfulness, reflecting on your own virtue or acting virtuously, all that's there right here, right now.
Yeah. He's taking the red pill, right?
There's the risk of death, which we get rid of by going into the machine, at least temporarily, right? So if we live with the risk of death, we can treat every day, so the way he puts it, as if we were bringing up the rear and rounding off and filling out life, which is a variation on carpe diem, but it's not the same thing. It's not just...
The Stoics used to say hic et nunc, right? So here and now, as in that's where you are. You are here, you're now, and that's your life, but not the same thing as carpe diem. It's more a thing like... It can be actually connected back to Epictetus' dichotomy of control, right? So what's gone, it's in the past, it's not under your control. So why the hell are you worried about it? And what's in the future is not here yet either. So that's also outside of your control. Well, the only thing you can control is how you act and how you think right now, right here.
Yeah, but it's also that you see this day as the last day, and you see the last day as a telos in the sense of completion. This last day completes everything, and I'm going to live it as if it were the, you know, the sort of the period at the end of the sentence, which is a different way of living than if you think the sentence is just going to keep going on.
That's right. And in this, I have to say, all of the Roman Stoics agree. I mean, you find something like that in Seneca, in Epictetus, and in Marcus Aurelius.
The way you guys are talking about it right now, I'm not sure that it disagrees with what I was reading in the Stoics, but it does seem in contrast, this idea of living as if every moment is the end of your sentence. That seems different to me than being present in an activity that's ongoing, even if you, with an eye towards what would be in the future, right? Because it seems to be hard, very hard to account for something like ambition or even wanting to do anything if you're really in the mode of being present at the end of your sentence all the time. So there seems to be something you have to hold together at the same time. You have to be in the midst of an action in which you are present for that action, but also conscious of it being an action, an activity that you're going through.
And that the emphasis is the journey, and that it's the virtues, yes, in what you're doing, not that you actually accomplish it, but you have to still want to accomplish it.
Yeah, it's like being on a ship and you're sailing. Well, you're sailing towards something, right? But you're not there. You have to be on the ship to tend to the sails and tend to the lines and adjust the tiller. And there's all kinds of things you have to do in order to get there. You have to be present in that activity. And to do that successfully, to have the mental fortitude and the discipline to do it, you have to be there on the ship then, right, in order to make it. But you have a goal. You have, you know, there's a place you want to reach, right?
Here, I think that what might be helpful is a metaphor that comes out of Cicero, the Philebus. In book 3, what he talks about, what he has actually, Cato the Younger, explaining the Stoic system. He brings up this metaphor of the archer and trying to hit the target. And so he says that what is under control of the archer is to make your best effort to, you know, try to aim as best as you can and tense your muscles in the best way you can, and so on and so forth. But once you let go of the arrow, of course, the ultimate outcome is not up to you, because all sorts of things can happen, a gust of wind, and your arrow is going to go away completely outside of the target. And so what he says, Cicero, through Cato, says, you do prefer a particular outcome, but the only thing you can choose is your effort.
Right.
And that actually makes a sense. So it makes more sense than just saying, oh, live right here, right now. It's not that you don't have goals. I mean, clearly, everything we know about the biographies of these people, Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, and so on, it's clear that they did have long-term goals,
yeah,
and acted accordingly. But what they were also trying to do in reminding themselves of this thing, you know, you could die any moment. It's like, you don't live as if you had forever. Make every single action that you have count and remind yourself that certain things are not under your control, and so you're going to accept the outcome with equanimity.
Yeah, and I think it's also worthwhile pointing out that this passage isn't exactly, that we were just reading, isn't exactly about living in the moment. It's about the last day. So it's like I get up in the morning and I make my to-do list and I plan out what I would do with my last day. And the idea of having it round off, that, you know, if it is the last day, in what sense could I make it round off the rest of my life? Well, it's not going to be because I finally finished the novel or something like that. The rounding off has to do with precisely all these Stoic comportments to things. So it's not, for instance, treating objects of pleasure as if they were good things to be pursued. But of course, when I make that to-do list, if I'm going to do anything at all, there have to be things that I select to do and things that I deselect that have nothing to do with good and bad. But the rounding off part comes in the sort of second level virtue of the reasonable way I selected them and the focus on being a virtuous person, that, let's say, that's the telos, and that's the way the last day becomes a telos, by focusing on what's truly good.
It does seem that the Stoic, in addition to making the to-do list, part of that would have to be making the not-to-do list.
There's one other thing that I'd like to sort of bring up and maybe get your feelings about it. This is actually in letter 12 on old age and,
yep,
or in the new translation, visiting a childhood home. Number 11 in particular. Now, let me set this up. So you might have noticed that in several of the initial letters, of the early letters, eventually he drops this thing. But in every one of the initial letters, he ends always the letter to Lucilius by saying, okay, I need to pay my tribute to you. And the tribute is usually a phrase or a saying by somebody that he thinks may be useful to Lucilius. And you may have noticed that very often, in fact, almost always, that someone is actually Epicurus, mm-hmm, which is kind of curious because the Epicureans and the Stoics didn't really see eye to eye at all. In fact, if you read that, you know, the discourses in Epictetus, he has a couple of places where he really goes after the Epicureans in a pretty strong fashion. But that is one of the things that I like about Seneca, that he was in some sense more ecumenical about things. There is a bit, I don't remember where it is, it's not in the letters, where he says that we're not the last generation, other people will come by and learn new things, and so we need to be open sort of to change our minds about stuff. But in this particular case, he explains to Lucilius why he keeps citing Epicurus. So he's at number 11 here of letter 12. He says, Epicurus said that, you say. What business have you with another's property? Whatever is true is my own. And I find that beautiful. It's like, you know, just because somebody from another school or from another persuasion said that, hey, if it's right, if it gets at something interesting, if it gets at something truthful, what the hell? It's everybody's property.
Well, and truths are immortal outside space and time, and they can't perish away. So, yes, it's mine.
But notice that he does attribute to Epicurus. He just doesn't make it take just make it into its own.
It's fair use.
That's right. It's fair use.
And there's no tragedy of the commons. You're not going to use it all up for everybody else.
That's right.
So just for proper attribution, the sci-fi that I was thinking of where you're about to die and so you get put into a machine that slows down your consciousness and lets you live for a long time is Hard-Boiled Wonderland at the End of the World by Murakami. Haruki Murakami.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yes, a fun book. I love any Murakami. The other cultural touchstone, as we've been going through this and as I was reading it, I had just watched again with my family. They really liked the Pixar movie Inside Out that just came out.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
So thinking of this, you know, in terms of what emotions are you tolerating? What are you neglecting? Is all anger bad? That it's got a very teleological take on that, you know, each of the emotions is a little homunculus that sits in your head and it has its own role to do, and disgust and anger are put out there immediately as things that have a positive function, that they both serve to achieve your goals and keep you from getting poisoned in certain things. And then the big puzzle of the whole movie is like, well, what is the use of sadness? Why is sadness even there? Can't we just shove sadness in the corner? And the big revelation of the movie is like, oh yes, sadness has a function too. It has a social function, which I won't give away. No spoilers, but and so I kind of like that take on, you know, I would hope that a good interpretation of Stoicism would take more of that functional take on the so-called negative emotions than what is actually written here in Seneca talking about the negative emotions of how, I don't see why you'd want a moderate amount of sickness.
Well, this is why I'm interested in this whole Freudian notion of mourning. And my psychoanalyst friends, of course, love this movie Inside Out. This whole idea that sadness and mourning are important, and they're important for maturation, which is what Inside Out gets really right. It's a maturational step to be able to mourn. And on the face of it, it looks like there's this conflict. It looks like the Stoics are advising us that mourning is a bad thing. The maturational mourning, the mourning you do as you grow up, on the psychoanalytic view, sort of prepares you to have a different comportment towards the world. It's no longer, you know, if you don't mature, then things are good and bad in this very amplified sense. In other words, in the precisely the sense that the Stoics disadvised. So you could see Stoicism as sort of a preemptive mourning. I'm conscious that I might die. So I think there's some hidden commonalities there between Stoicism and other ways of looking at things.
But that's an interesting point. And of course, it's hard in the movie to get upset with anger because it's played by Lewis Black, who's absolutely brilliant, I think.
The point you're making, Wes, is the one thing that I wonder, is it there in the Stoicism or is it a case that it ought to be there in the Stoicism? Meaning you mourn, but you understand that that is, you have sort of the right disposition with respect to it. It doesn't overtake you completely. You have a perspective on it and it's part of being full human, as well as same things with pleasure or with other states of emotion, that it's not that you would repress them, but you would have the right comportment with respect to them. Now, what I don't know in saying that is it sounds like it could be in line with the way I'm, you know, read Stoicism, but there's so many other things that are said outrightly that makes it seem like, well, maybe it ought to be the way one thinks of Stoicism, or maybe that's the way like Stoicism 2.0 would be.
A living tradition, yes.
But it doesn't sound like what I read in Stoicism. What I read in Stoicism sounds much more hard-bitten.
So I think it's a difficult question, and a lot of it depends on how much we can fit into this concept of joy, for instance, or the other healthy emotions. But
yeah. Well, I look forward to your essay, as I do all of them.
Can we just put all this?
It's going to take some time.
In objet a, or what? I'm trying to remember the Lacanian term where you dump all the stuff you can't articulate.
Well, it's precisely the point is not to be fixated on the objet a. That's what that's really the non-Stoic. You know, if you want this kind of synthetic interpretation where we put all these ideas together, the non-Stoic is entranced with what Lacan calls the imaginary. So anyway.
Oh, that's an interesting one. I'll have to think about that.
I hope this serves as an adequate invitation to go to Massimo's blog and follow him on his Stoic adventures. And, you know, I've been suspicious of using philosophy to actually help yourself. That just as I am suspicious of people using philosophy, you know, the only kind of good philosophy is like the science philosophy, because that actually has a practical benefit and you can get a job. Likewise, I'm very suspicious of many of our other competitor philosophy podcasts that try to turn it into a self-help, you know, that it just seems like that sort of stuff really oversimplifies things in a disgusting way. And Seneca is full of that, is the closest we've come to reading a self-help guru that, oh yeah, you just have to have the truth laid out completely in front of you and have perfect wisdom completely in mind. And it's all easy. You don't need big words to describe this, but if one reads charitably and sees it as a living tradition and maybe allows the interesting things that Nietzsche and Freud and everybody else has discovered since then, you know, maybe following the more Nietzschean, listen to my body and don't impose principles on myself. And I got to admit it, on a day-to-day basis, that doesn't always work out all that well, just in terms of maintaining a good dietary and exercise habits and all the other stuff that you want to do. So I do see quite a lot of value, you know, when I was looking at your website, Massimo, and just thinking about Stoicism as a way of having a practice that is free of things that people like Alvin Plantinga would have you have to accept, even if it's not really accepting a matter of fact, even if there's more complicated than that. I do see the advantages of doing this over a regular religion. So this is not the text that I found was the most meaty that we've ever taken on or that had the most great insights in it, but certainly there's a lot of nice quotable stuff, and I appreciated being introduced to this realm of practical Stoicism.
Yeah, I'm glad. You know, remember again that we're talking about the project that I'm interested in and that a number of other people are interested in is to use the ancient Stoics as a general framework and as an inspiration, but certainly not as a, you know, the equivalent of a religious text. Whatever. If Seneca said something and it doesn't make sense to me, I'm just not going to do it only because Seneca said it, I should do it. But at the same time, I also appreciated your point about reading these texts, any text really, charitably. I mean, that to me is, that is one of the values of good philosophy. You always try to read even your worst opponents or people that you don't have particularly high regard for charitably, because there may be something you can learn there, even if you end up disagreeing with them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I will say I'm enormously attracted to Stoicism, although, you know, I've spent a lot of time with psychoanalysis and sort of the friends of instinct, let's say, and the friends of the passions and the idea of taking a therapeutic approach to them. But again, it's agnostic about the degree to which they're in conflict and the degree to which they're having interesting commonalities. But yeah, so for instance, when I read Epictetus, not only was it interesting, it sort of was profoundly affecting. It was like a little dose of cognitive therapy, which unfortunately I find, because I don't have a practice, it doesn't last, but it remains something that's attractive to me, and, you know, as do other practices like mindfulness and things like that. So yeah, it's something I still want to explore further.
Dylan, you were the most nice about Epictetus, I noticed when reviewing that. So you didn't maybe have as much of a chip to knock off your shoulder here.
I didn't. Well, I find the Stoics attractive mainly from the standpoint of a combination of thoughtful discipline and the kinds of things in Aristotle's virtue, the notion of habit and cultivation of what one wants to do. And to me, the way I often frame it to myself, which is not exactly in line with the Stoics, but is more like it's work to do what you really want to do. That is, it's work to become who you want to be, that kind of thing. And whether you call it a practice, whether you call it habits, whether you call it having a equanimous disposition towards the world around you or your own successes and failures, I think there's something in common with all of those things that I find myself resonating with. So all the crazy stuff that Epictetus says, it just kind of rolls off, because I sort of secretly feel like, nah, he didn't really mean that. And I know that's not very disciplined of me in terms of reading it.
But I know what you mean. I actually have had similar reactions sometimes. And also, you know, because it is actually hard to tell exactly one email. First of all, remember, you know, Epictetus didn't actually write anything down. What we have are students' notes. Mm-hmm. And I can only imagine, and with, you know, shuddering terror, what would happen if the only things of mine that reached the next generation were notes taken by my students in class. It's like, oh, no. So, you know, you gotta be careful, because it may very well be the case that in some cases he really did not actually mean that. And that was just his students' misinterpretation of things. You know? So there's quite a bit of room for interpretation there.
Well, unlike what you said, Dylan, I like Schopenhauer, who I think is a very good Stoic in many ways. I like to blame others for my lack of success rather than
there you go.
Buckling down. So. All right. Next time, we are going to talk about love. I'm glad we got going on this. Somebody emailed us and said, hey, Valentine's is coming up. You should do that. You should do something about love. And so we had something in the kitty about love. Anyway, we're going to read Eric Fromm's The Art of Loving in honor of Valentine's Day. I hope folks, in addition to checking out Massimo's blog, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, check out all the blogging that we have going on there. If you listeners are interested in Stoicism or any of the other topics we talk about, want to maybe contribute to the blog, go look for the link that says write for us there and see what kind of stuff we accept. We'd love to have more voices on there. Easy way, without our policing, to get in dialogue with us and other Partially Examined Life listeners is to go on our enormously active Facebook group. Put some things in there. Follow us on Twitter. Connect with us on LinkedIn. Follow the wisdom of Ask Chicky on Instagram. That's instagram.com/AskChicky. I'm just going to keep pushing this thing until it breaks.
And Massimo, your blog is howtobeastoic.wordpress.com?
Yes, or howtobeastoic.org.
Okay. And then you have a book coming out next year, right? How to Be a Stoic? Or?
I'm actually working on it. I'm on sabbatical right now, and I'm working on the book, yes. The manuscript is due to Basic Books at the end of August.
Great. All right. Yeah. Thank you very much. This was great.
Thanks for coming on, Massimo. It was wonderful.
It was a lot of fun.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye.
Control. And love was facing me. No longer hold. arms and legs were shaking, blood was pouring. I was jumping, stop was shooting, wind was blowing, things was going, I was showing you up so in love with you.
My heart grows inside, yeah.